This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your numbers are 297-5633 in Baton Rouge, outside our area. Toll free, 877-217-5757. You can send us an email at talk@talklouisiana.org. Ali Baltazar is producing, and our leadoff guest is Bob Marshall, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's covered the people, stories, and environmental issues of Louisiana's wetlands for four decades. He is an avid outdoorsman, spent much of his adult life in the marshes and swamps of South Louisiana, charting the demise of wetlands he calls my office and playground. Good morning, Bob Marshall.
Good morning, Jim.
Nice to hear your distinctive voice. Now, Bob Marshall, you began as a sports writer many moons ago.
Yes, I did. I was pretty amazing. My first job at the States Item, almost right out of college, was covering the Saints in the NFL, which in those days were two distinct entities. The Saints were pretty awful then.
That was early 1970s New Orleans Saints, and they weren't very good, but you were a very good writer, and along the way you segued into becoming the foremost environmental writer in our state. How did that transformation occur?
Well, I don't know if I'm the foremost environmental writer, but I started doing features and stories on my, you know, my longtime love of outdoor sports of all kinds, and especially on what I was seeing out in March. I started an outdoor section. I left sports writing to start a section called Venture for the Times-Picayune, 1981, a different type of outdoor reporting. Covered all self-participatory sports, but obviously with a focus on the two major outdoor sports here, which would be fishing and then hunting. As a journalist on that beat, you cover the things that affect the beat, and you can't have outdoor sports without a healthy outdoors, and that's where environmental reporting comes in. And like most sportsmen here, people spend their time on the other side of these levees. Commercial and recreational fishermen and hunters were noticing what was happening to our wetlands, how they were falling apart. And so I began, as a journalist, asking questions of the scientists and the state agencies and federal agencies, you know, why was this happening? And that's how I got into, you know, this wetlands reporting and environmental reporting. And then, you know, over the years, began working with, you know, really a great environmental reporter at the Times-Picayune, Mark Schlesstein, and John McQuaid, another reporter, doing various series first on the Gulf of Mexico, the oceans, and then, of course, on the wetlands here and the demise of the wetlands and the contributing factors and, you know, all the other things that go with that.
How significant is the problem right now with coastal erosion and the wetlands going away?
Well, it's not an exaggeration to say this is an existential threat to the bottom third of the state, anything from I-10 south and several miles on the north side of the I-10. This whole part of the state is sinking for a variety of reasons, the sea is rising. And you add those two things together, and all the projections, all the measured changes over the last couple of decades show that we've had like four times the rate of sea level rise than most of the rest of the country. 0.40 millimeters a year, where the rest of the country's been seeing the oceans rise at about 2.4 to 3.2 millimeters a year. They call it, when you add subsidence to your static sea level rise, you get relative sea level rise. So it's not hard to understand. We're sinking at the same time the ocean's rising. And at the current rates of both, which, projections for sea level rise keep being ratcheted upward. The National Climate Assessment now says that we're looking at about 2.8 to 3.2 feet of eustatic sea level rise by the end of the century, and the southern part of the state, really from Lake Charles to, you know, New Orleans, is sinking at various rates. It's not uniform, but, you know, as high as an inch every 30 months, which is about 18 inches in 50 years and 3 feet in a century, and that's been going on for more than a decade. So when you add the two together, it's pretty grim. And NOAA has said that this part of the nation will see the highest rate of sea level rise, relative sea level rise, by the end of the century, 5 feet, possibly more. And when you consider the average elevation in southeast Louisiana is about 2.5 feet, you don't need to be a MIT math whiz to figure out that we're going to be in serious trouble. And so, you know, it is a threat to the very future of this part of the state. In fact, that is the state's official position for its coastal master plan, is that we're, you know, to use a football analogy, which we all like to use each time of year, you know, the state is maybe on its own 3-yard line. We're out of timeouts. We're down by 4 points, and there's 30 seconds left. So that's the kind of emergency this is.
Well, what can be done to avert what you have painted as an inevitable decline and demise of our state as we know it?
Well, it's the bottom part of the state, obviously. I think this goes, and I'm, you know, Baton Rouge. Still, I'm sure it would reach all the way up to Baton Rouge. It's getting close anyway, even now. The state has embarked, of course, on the Coastal Master Plan, which, you know, is really, every Louisianian should be very proud of this. This is remarkable science and engineering. It's cutting edge. It's generally considered the most advanced climate science-based climate adaptation plan in this nation, and one of the most advanced and sound anywhere in the world. It's been put together by not only our fine and growing body of coastal scientists and engineers, but also with help from experts from around the world. So we have a plan. It faces some large hurdles, the most important of which immediately is funding. It's going to cost, and it was released in 2007 at $50 million in 2010 dollars, $50 billion in 2010 dollars. But when you add inflation, it comes to about $92 to $100 billion over the 50 years of the plan, which is supposed to go through 2065. That plan faces the second largest obstacle is the sea level rise, which, you know, we not much we can do about subsidence except take the stuff out of the river, the sediment, and add it to some of these sinking basins. And that was the plan all along, to rebuild some of these, you know, to put stuff into this growing hole, basically, and raise it back up to the level above the sea. But the sea keeps rising at an ever-accelerating rate. And the major cause of that is greenhouse gas emissions, which have warmed the atmosphere. The ocean's been absorbing this increased warmth over 100 years. And now when you warm water, it expands. So that's part of the problem, the cause of sea level rise.
All right.
And then water stored as ice on land is melting, pouring into this big pot. So that's what's increasing it. And over the last 5 to 10 years, the measured rates of this rise have increased higher than what was expected, what was projected 10 years ago. And the causes of the expansion of the oceans, the two main contributing factors, the main contributing factor in emissions, continue to grow, and the air keeps getting warmer and the ocean keeps getting warmer. Mm-hmm. And much higher rates of melting have taken place on these ice sheets in Greenland and now in Antarctica. So what's happened is, although we have this great plan, which originally, until the new plan came out this year, said that by 2065 we would be, if everything was implemented as scheduled and worked according to the computer projections, we could be building more land than we're losing by 2065. And the 2017 plan says, no, that's not going to happen. And the reason is the increased projections and measurements on sea level rise. So now what we're hoping to do is, even if everything works according to plan, we get the money and all the projects are built and implemented on the schedule and the plan, we would still lose 1,000 to 1,200 square miles. We would probably gain 800 to 1,200 square miles. That's with emissions, if emissions are controlled.
And that's if everything goes right. Now, in our congressional delegation, independent of the rest of the country, we don't have a lot of people talking about this. In fact, we have many who dismiss climate change. The only ones I know about who've had any kind of assessment such as yours are Cedric Richmond and Garrett Graves. What's going on with our delegation? We're going to take a break and talk about this with Bob Marshall, the veteran outdoors reporter who spent many years in New Orleans with the States Item and the Times-Picayune, and is now continuing to blog about his passion, the environment of Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, 297-5633, and talk at talklouisiana.org. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. Bob Marshall is our guest, the veteran outdoors reporter and certainly a champion of the environment in Louisiana. He just painted a grim picture if the state and the nation do not do something to address the vanishing Louisiana wetlands. 877-217-5757 is your number. Bob, I mentioned that our congressional delegation has not really been that active, and in fact, in some cases, they've been downright obstinate in saying that climate change is not something that we should really worry about. Your thoughts?
Well, I consider that political malpractice.
Okay, you're not coming in very strongly now. So
okay,
that's better. That's better. Yes.
Okay, yeah, I consider that political malpractice, basically. You know, the truth is there. The state's official position on this, which is in the master plan, says exactly that, that if emissions are not controlled, we'll lose, even if everything works perfectly, we'll still lose 1,200 square miles. This is not, you know, little pieces of land where insignificant numbers of people live. This is places all around Lake Charles, Houma, Morgan City, New Orleans, all these towns along the coast. This involves the infrastructure for the nation's second leading producing area for oil and gas. It's incredibly important to the economy of the nation and obviously this state, not to mention about 3 million people. You know, when people say, like, these politicians, these congressmen, oh, I don't believe it. I say, well, what do you do for a living? What's your degree in? Or maybe I'm a lawyer or a doctor, or maybe I'm not. Maybe I'm a retired military or whoever. Why? What makes you an expert on this? You know, if I'm sick and I go to my doctor and the doctor says you have cancer and shows me the x-rays or the MRIs and everything and the blood work, I'm not going to say I don't believe you. I'm a journalist. I'm not a doctor. To me, it's a suicide mission. But when you talk to these politicians off the record, they'll tell you this is what their constituents believe. They don't. What we're talking about here specifically is what they oppose are primarily are regulations on emissions. And there's been Jim, there's been a subtle shift from outright denial of this is. This is all a conspiracy, which is, you know, just a crazy, there's no evidence of that. It's just kind of a crazy thing to say. Then it kind of it moved backwards to, I'm a skeptic. And now most of these folks are saying, well, you know, humans have probably adding to this, but we're not convinced it's a major cause. And in fact, even Garrett Graves, who was head of the CPRA, told me on more than one occasion that he's not sure if it's anthropogenic, meaning man-caused, or biogenic, meaning just natural. And, you know, that's kind of a litmus test for Republicans in office. It's just kind of, you know, just like you have to be a small government, you have to be a skeptic on the cures or addressing the causes of this, even if you then grudgingly admit it's happening.
877-217-5757 or 297-5633 for Bob Marshall. David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Marshall, I revere you for your columns at NOLA.com. I read them religiously, and I'd like to respectfully request you point out a couple of scientific facts in a future column. I've had many of my conservative friends tell me that volcanoes put more CO2 in the atmosphere than, say, human behavior does. A NASA scientist, I had the article in my computer, did a study and found that less than 1% of the CO2 in the atmosphere was put there by volcanoes. And secondly, NASA has a satellite that can observe the infrared reflected heat from the surface of the planet Earth being absorbed by CO2. CO2 is a greenhouse gas, and if you chart the temperature of the planet Earth from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, consistently temperatures have risen decade by decade up until the present time, and this is not normal climate change because scientists have gone back many, many thousands and thousands of years and have never found the rapid increase in temperature like we are experiencing at this time. And
all right, I want to get Bob Marshall to respond, David. Bob, your thoughts about the sentiments expressed by David in Atlanta.
David, I want you to write my next column. all those are absolutely valid points. The evidence is there. It's to me, it's like people are saying when you put 1 and 1 together, you get 11 and not 2. The evidence is there. The facts are there. It's what do you say to people who don't, who'd say, I disagree? And I get this all the time as well. A lot of people I like, respect, and know. And I'll go back to my other point. You know, why would you think you know more than 97% of the people who study this for a living? It's certainly become, unfortunately, part of the political debate, and this isn't politics, it's math. There's no politics in math.
Rose in Sherwood Forest. Rose, you're on the air with Bob Marshall.
Good morning, Bob. Listen, I'm an LSU grad, and I want to just state for the record that back in 1973, a friend of mine and I did some research up in North Baton Rouge at Earl K. Long and proved that people in that part of our parish that are close to Exxon are getting pneumonia and all sorts of lung diseases twice as often as the people living in the South Side. So that's, you know, there's another evidence of climate, so-called climate change. You know what I'm saying? It's pollution, period. Thank you.
All right. We have issues independent of the one that you and I are discussing, Bob, and all kinds of environmental concerns, and yet I don't see our state leaders, by and large, talking a whole lot about it.
Well, that's been one of the great failures here. None of our governors, for example, have, when you think of what is this governor known as, and most recently, say, Bobby Jindal, you know, he was a hardcore conservative, no taxes. Before that, of course, Governor Blanco was probably known for Katrina. Governor Foster was known for not too much, you know, hands off. None of these people, if you mention their name, he's concerned about coastal Louisiana or climate change. And this is really the single most important issue facing the future of the state.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on with Bob Marshall.
Yes, it's part of the problem that the courts say that corporate lobbyists' right to free speech does not adversely affect the right of free speech of all the rest of society that doesn't have lobbyists to argue against the pollution.
Is there a corporate lobby that is an impediment to addressing the concerns that you have allayed this morning?
Well, I think these concerns are addressed every day in most of the media, most of the still legitimate newsrooms, and also all across the internet. But certainly, it's been proven, and it's being proven again, that the major polluters, mainly the fossil fuel industry, has been fighting the knowledge and the dissemination of information on climate change. But yeah, the information's out there; it's public. People people know about it. It's discussed. So I don't think their lobbying efforts have that much effect on the science, but I think it does. It has had an effect in creating this kind of bipolar nation on this issue, because people, unfortunately, you know, choose their media now what they want to listen to, and they don't. You know, there's a conservative media, Fox News, which runs many stories, media stories on questioning the science. And many people, you know, get their news from one source. And so I think some of these papers are produced by organizations supported by these lobbyists, by these industries.
Right. 877-217-5757 is your number. Still time to talk with Bob Marshall. We will spend a few more minutes with him, and then we'll hear from we'll hear from George Bevan. George Bevan, the great LSU player. Now the news with Karen Henderson on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757. Coming in a few moments, we'll hear from former LSU great George Bevan. We're now talking with Bob Marshall, as we have for the last few segments. Pulitzer Prize winner from 1996. He wrote a series with others, Oceans of Trouble, examining the plight of the world's fisheries and the decline of Louisiana's coastal wetlands, and this remains a significant issue. And if you've heard Bob in the last half hour, he says that the century we're in right now could tell the tale as far as the future of our state, as far as literally whether we're here or not, as far as the southern part of Louisiana. Ray in Prairieville. Hi, Ray. You're on the air with Bob Marshall.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for picking the call. I'd like to congratulate Mr. Marshall for his stand on this, and I'd also like to know how we could get it further publicized. Obviously, our state legislatures are not listening to any of this about climate change, but the real disheartening part is the fact that our president and the head of the national EPA also deny that climate change is real. I'd like Mr. Marshall to say how we can get more publicity out there. I'll take my answer.
Okay, go ahead, Bob Marshall.
Well, I think the publicity is out there. This has really come down to a matter of party politics. Polls show that whatever, you know, only 10 or 12% of registered Republican voters quote, believe climate science. When I tell people in this state, since it's a red state, the best thing you can do is join the Republican Party and change it, because that's the party that's stopping this stuff. You can look at this administration and its leaders in Congress, including most of our congressional delegation. So since I don't think we'll be electing a whole bunch of Democrats here, maybe the way to go is to find green Republicans, get them nominated, and get them elected.
Mike in St. James Parish. Mike, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Bob Marshall.
Yes, sir. How you doing this morning?
Fine.
Okay, I have a couple of points I'd like to bring up about the whole global warming thing. I don't really believe in the global warming thing, and I have a couple reasons for it. Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Okay, I worked in instrumentation 40 years. I mean, I recently retired in 2013. And, I mean, this whole temperature thing leaves a lot of suspect. I mean, they're saying, like an inconvenient truth, he's saying we're measuring a tenth of a degree average temperature change globally. I mean, that's ridiculous. We can't measure temperature in tenths of degrees, not accurately. I mean, they have charts and graphs and everything that say we can, but in actuality, we can't. In 40 years, I've never seen where we were able to measure that. Okay, the second point I'd like to bring up is they're saying that the CO2 level worldwide is increasing. Well, the worldwide measurement for CO2 is measured on Mount Mauna Loa in Hawaii. Well, it's on the same island as Kilauea, which is the most active volcano in the world. So, I mean, how can they say that this is the most accurate measure? You know, we're getting over 400 parts per billion carbon dioxide in the atmosphere when they're measuring it on the same island as an active volcano.
All right, let's get Bob's response. Thank you, Mike. Bob?
Well, that's not accurate. The CO2 measurements are done worldwide. They're not taken from one spot. You know, with all due respect to the listener, you know, I'm sure he has his opinion, but there are several thousand full-time climatologists who have studied this or continue to study it, and their papers have been questioned and challenged, and they still come out to show that this is what's happening. The measurements are not done from one spot. This is some of the stuff you see on various internet sites, and you know, most of them can be shot down pretty quickly. If you go to the appendices of the papers written, and they'll show you where all these measurements are taken and how they're taken. A lot of it done is done now by satellite.
All right. Chank in Sanama, you'll be our final caller for Bob Marshall today. Good morning, sir. Okay, I think we lost a caller from Sanama. But, Bob, do you see any change as far as the concern that you have expressed? As I mentioned, you won a Pulitzer Prize with others in 1996. That's been more than 20 years. If the next 20 years are like the past 20 years as far as addressing this issue, where will we be in 2037?
Well, if the nation doesn't join the world and really reducing the rate of emissions, then I think Louisiana Coastal Master Plan will be under some serious revision, because by then the projections and the actual measurements, again, of sea level rise will probably by then, in this worst case scenario, begin to show that some of the projects will not work as they're currently projected to work. So, yeah, 10 years, I would say that within 10 years, if there isn't significant progress on this, showing a better outcome, say by 2060, then, yeah, the state will already begin moving people from communities south of US 90 and that whole area. Yeah, we've got 10 years probably. I think I read that at a couple of places, even a shorter time period to get moving on this issue.
Thank you so much, Bob Marshall. Let's talk again soon.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care. And we're joined in studio by George Bevan, one of the great LSU football players. And if you look at George, who just turned 70 years old, he looks like he could still play, but most people would say the sport wasn't football. He was an All-American linebacker, first-team All-American. The best defense in the nation in 1969 was led by the team captain, George Bevan. George, the game's changed a little bit in the last 48 years.
You nailed it, Jim. Changed tremendously.
But in those days, a lot of players played on both sides of the ball. And now we have the specialists, and the players are bigger. They're stronger, maybe even faster. But when I say bigger, you see fat guys on the field. You didn't have any fat guys on your team.
No, we didn't. I think our largest offensive lineman probably weighed about 220 pounds. So a little different game.
Yeah. And you were 5'11 and listed at 190, probably. That would be pushing it, wouldn't it?
A little bit. I recall when I was a freshman, appeared on campus, we had an athletic trainer named Dr. Marty Broussard, who was really well known. And they measured me. I think I was 5'10", 185 pounds. He said, "That's not going to scare anybody, son. We're going to put you down as 5'11", 195. So that's what I was listed as my 4 years at LSU.
And unlike a lot of players, instead of gaining weight, you've lost weight. I can tell you're in great shape, but you don't weigh 185 pounds now.
Not quite.
What do you weigh, about 170?
About 170, yeah.
170.
Yeah.
That's fabulous.
I think back then I wore a 44 jacket, and today I wear a 42, so those little things change.
And I bet at 180 or 185, you were probably bench pressing 240, 250.
That was, and I was probably one of the top on the team. We had a great coach in Coach McClendon, but he did not believe we. You know, his idea of weightlifting was to go into the one of the rooms, and we'd wrestle. That was his idea of how he got stronger.
Yeah, the old school guys, and this is not only for baseball, but football, but baseball and basketball, was that you'd get all tightened up to the point where you couldn't move around if you lifted weights too much.
Well, they really didn't want us to swim either, though, because that would elongate your muscles, and they didn't believe that was the right thing. But, you know, it was a different game. We had no hydration. We had a salt tablet, and halfway through practice, we'd stop. They'd give us a frozen orange.
That's it.
And I think, you know, the young men today, they're all bigger, and that's a little genetic, but they're stronger and faster because they're able to work harder. Because when you're hydrated, you can work a lot longer than when you're not hydrated. So,
but as I have noted a few times, 18 players on the current LSU team are above 300 pounds. Your heaviest guy in 1969 was what?
I'd said about 220. And the largest guy I ever played against was a center from Ole Miss who weighed about 240. Other than that, a big lineman again was between 220 and 235. Yes.
So at about 180, 185 pounds, George Bevan was a first-team All-American in 1969, and that LSU team was one of the great teams in all of college football then and now. Only lost one game by 3 points to Ole Miss. Archie Manning rallied the Rebels to victory in Jackson, but by all rights, you should have been playing Texas for the national title in the Cotton Bowl.
Well, we thought we had that opportunity. We played one of our last games of the year, and we beat Mississippi State pretty handily. And we went to the locker room, and Coach Mack said we had been offered an opportunity to play in the Cotton Bowl, and we unanimously agreed to take that opportunity. Then the next morning, we found out that Notre Dame had broken a tradition of not going to bowl games, and we're left out in the cold.
So you opted not to go to any bowl?
Well, we really didn't have any opportunity. There was some saying that we might have been able to go to the Blue Bonnet Bowl, but we were very despondent, and we'd have loved to play the team with a record or equal to ours or better than ours, and that's what we were not able to do that. And so I think it was just a low moment, and we elected not to go to any potential bowl game.
We're talking to George Bevan, who not only was a first-team All-American linebacker at 5'10" and a half and 185 pounds. He also had four operations on his Achilles tendon before his senior year. One of the real heroic stories in LSU football lore. We'll talk more about him and what's going on now with the Tigers when we return after this timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Talk Louisiana on WRKF. A reminder that today the Founders Luncheon will take place at the Crown Plaza for WRKF with the keynoter Dean Baquet, the man who has the top editorial position at the New York Times, native of New Orleans, and he is in town. George Bevan, one of the great Baton Rougeans, is with us. He was a first-team All-American in 1969. That LSU team outscored the opposition by about 20 points a game in 1969, and lost one game to Ole Miss, 26-23 in Jackson. And George Bevan, at 5'10" and a half, 185 pounds, was a first-team All-American. He played at Baton Rouge High and led the Bulldogs, Baton Rouge High, a school that no longer has football, to the 1964 state title. That must have been quite an experience.
It was. It was. We had been a kind of a second layer team to the old Struma school. And we ended up getting a couple of the Struma coaches, a guy named Ray Porter, who's no longer with us, and Leon McGraw. And they made a big difference, I think. Baton Rouge High beat a Struma the 3 years that they were there. So coaching does make a difference.
Well, Baton Rouge High is a great school, but it's kind of sad that they no longer have football and basketball there.
Well, we're proud of it, and they've done a great job with the school district here, allowing the school to put the money in, and a very active fundraising group for Baton Rouge High. It's a great school.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned that in addition to your All-American status in 1969, many thought you'd never play again. Prior to that season, you ripped your Achilles tendon and had four surgeries?
Correct. Yeah, I had Dr. Alvin Stander, who in fact delivered me as a baby, was an orthopedic surgeon, went back, and they ended up doing a very experimental surgery, cutting a piece of tendon from my thigh and wrapping it around, and that's the last one they did, and finally it took place and healed. And it's a big tendon. It's like a deer tendon. Yeah. It's so big because of that extra tendon that was wrapped around it.
Well, Bud Johnson, who was a sports information director at the time, he said your leg had atrophied to the point where people thought you no way this guy's ever going to play football again.
I was in a full length cast from my toe to my hip for exactly 1 year. And it was not pretty when it got out.
How long did it take to get it back?
Well, I started in the rehabilitation, the last rehabilitation, September of 1968. And by the end of the year, I was able to practice. I did not play because I'd lost that year of eligibility, but I was able to practice with the team for the Peach Bowl, which was the first. We were the first team to play in the Peach Bowl and beat the Florida State team.
And you had some great players on the team with you in 69.
Oh, I had the greatest. I had Mike Anderson, the linebacker. I had John Sage, all-SEC tackle. I had Ronnie Este. I had Tommy Casanova. So I had some of the greatest teammates in the world, both as persons and as football players.
The team led the nation in rushing defense, gave up 389 yards rushing for the whole season, 38.9 yards a game. That's a number that many teams exceed in one game.
Well, we played some good teams, but we had some good schemes, and we felt very comfortable when we went in against anyone that we could stop them.
You mentioned those players, and the only one to have NFL success was Casanova. Charlie McClendon, he was a defensive coach himself. He had this habit of getting overachievers. I don't think there's any doubt that there were other teams that had as much physical talent, but how did you convey that into the record I just mentioned that was among the best in the nation?
Well, that's a good point. Tommy Casanova tells a story. He got drafted by Cincinnati, telling the Cincinnati coaches how good the LSU players were, and they kind of laughed at him. They said they don't know how Charlie McClendon did it every year. We didn't have one star, two stars, three stars, or five stars, but Coach Mack obviously was able to take a bunch of two stars and turn them into pretty good football players.
Well, tomorrow at the Lod Cook Hotel in the Shaquille O'Neal Lodge, George Bevan will be there at 10:30, and he and I will pick up this conversation and talk about some other matters. But you still follow the Tigers to this day?
Oh, my God. Well, certainly I follow them, yes. And we're all disappointed last Saturday night, but that's football is not a round ball. It bounces a lot of different ways.
Well, it was a shocking loss to Mississippi State, and now Coach Orgeron has to rebound. Fortunately, he's got an opponent tomorrow night that LSU should handle rather easily in Syracuse, but you never know. Do you ever think about getting in coaching?
You know, I was loved football, played it all my life up until after college. I got drafted by the Buffalo Bills, had a great lawyer by the name of Jimmy Fields, who was a former Tiger, who's helped me sign a contract, but I wasn't going to play as a linebacker. And right before I was supposed to go up there, I tore up an ankle playing pickup basketball. Got into law school, got past that first year of law school, was offered an opportunity to come back, but I was drafted by the Buffalo Bills, and that's not exactly the greatest place in the world to live or to raise a family or to do anything. So I decided that becoming an attorney was a better thing for me.
And you married the daughter of the athletic director.
I did. I sure did.
Jim Corbett's yes. Daughter. And Corbett, he died much too young.
He was obviously a brilliant man. He accomplished some great things. He was actually, a lot of people don't know, one of the first people to bring, he worked for NBC and worked to bring college football mm-hmm. into the homes of everyone. And that was his job before he came to LSU.
But how was it? You're courting his daughter, you're playing for the Tigers, and he's the athletic director. That must have been an unusual knock on the door.
It was. I had contemplated visiting several other schools, Tennessee, Alabama in particular, and I think Mr. Corbett kind of talked me out of it. So he was a very dynamic person.
Well, it turned out okay for George Bevin.
It turned out great.
You've had a great career in business.
I enjoyed it. I practiced law for a number of years, and then back in the very early 90s, I had an opportunity to go to work for a company called the Shaw Group, which I did, and we were one time, I guess, one of the biggest employers in the state of Louisiana before we sold it.
And now you're back in another iteration.
Yes, it could be the bigger and greater. It's called Bernhard Capital Partners, and a couple of the executives who were with the Shaw Group, led by Jim Bernhardt, founded the company in 2014. We've had tremendous growth since then.
Jim Bernhardt is a guy who's had fabulous success in business, but I don't know of anything he's more passionate about than LSU football.
He loves it. He loves all LSU sports, football, basketball in particular. And over the years, Jim and the companies he's run have been big supporters of LSU in all aspects, both educational and sports-wise.
What is it about people like Bernhardt, who didn't play at LSU as you did, to have this kind of passion for their alma mater? And when you're around the guy, it's palpable when he starts talking about it.
Yeah, well, I think that's a thing certainly not exclusive to South Louisiana or all of Louisiana, but I think it's probably one of the most beloved universities from its alumni, and not only its alumni, but from people who have never been to the university. And I think we're very fortunate in having that. The old war school is just a grounds to bring everyone together.
Well, the mystique of Tiger Stadium has endured, and in the 1960s, it was perhaps an even more intimidating place for the opponents. You had the Tiger parked right outside the visitor's locker room.
Yes.
But when you ran under those goalposts, we're talking in the late 1960s, what was it like?
It's something that is still, it brings chills to you, even when you think about it. Put your head in a bell and have someone clang it a few times, and that's the noise and the enthusiasm that it created for the players. And it's something that the fans ought to be mm-hmm. proud of, and the players, it's a wonderful feeling.
And a listener asked if you had any residual issues from those four Achilles tendon surgeries.
I've been very lucky. I did have several years ago, I had to have some calcium removed from it and got infected, and I was on a wound catheter for quite a while, but it turned out good and everything's fine. I can play golf, I can jog, I can do anything I want to do. So I've been very blessed and I have no lingering injuries from playing the game.
I think keeping that weight down is a big part of it.
Well, it helps. I think so. And
I'm looking at you. I don't see any fat. You've got a lean waistline, George Bevin. You've taken good care of yourself.
Well, I've been blessed with some good, I guess, well, good mom and dad genes.
You got to work out a diet, too.
You do. You do, Jim.
Staying away from some of you probably don't eat at Mike Anderson's every night.
Well, I still like to go by and see Mike. And, every year now this will be our fourth year of meetings at Anderson with all the ex-football players.
Well, we'll see you tomorrow, 10:30, Lod Cook Hotel, George Bevin. Until Monday for Allie, I'm Jim. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.